Vimes walked round the table. All the bits, he thought. I must have all the bits now. Let's start with this legend of a dwarf turning up, nearly dead, weeks after the battle, babbling about treasure. All right. Then it might have been this talking cube thing, Vimes thought. He survived the battle, hid out somewhere, and he's got this thing, and it's important. He's got to get it somewhere safe. No, maybe he's got to get people to listen to it. And of course he doesn't take it with him, because there's still likely to be trolls wandering in the area, and right now they'll be in the mood to club first and try to think up some questions later. He needs some bodyguards. He gets as far as some humans, but when he's leading them back to the place where it's hidden, he finally dies. Forward 2,000 years. Would a cube last that long? Hell, they bob up in molten lava. So, it's lying there. Methodia Rascal comes along looking for a nice view or something, and he looks down, and there it is. Well, I have to accept that he did, because he found it and got it talking, who knows how. But he couldn't stop it. He drops it down the well. The dwarfs find it. They listen to the box, but hate what they hear. They hate it so much that Hamcrusher has 4 miners killed just because they heard it too. So why the painting? It shows what the box is talking about. Where the box is? If you've got the box in your hand, isn't that it? Anyway, whose was the voice doing the speaking? It could be anybody. Why would you believe what was said? He was aware of Sir Reynold talking to Carrot.
Send your Sergeant Colon here. The painting is set several miles from where the actual battle was fought. It's entirely the wrong part of Combe Valley. That's just about the one thing both sides are agreed on.
So why did he set it there? Said Vimes, staring at the table as if hoping to draw a clue from it by willpower alone.
Who knows? It's all Combe Valley. There's about 250 square miles of the place. I imagine he just chose somewhere that looked dramatic.
Would you chaps like a cup of tea? Said Lady Sybil from the door. I felt a bit of a loose end, so I made a pot. And you should be getting your head down, Sam.
Sam Vimes looked panicky, a figure of authority caught once again in a domestic situation.
"Oh, Lady Sybil, they took the rascal," said Sir Reynold. "I know it belonged to your family."
"My grandfather said it was just a damn nuisance," said Sybil. "He used to let me unroll it on the floor of the ballroom. I used to name all the dwarfs. We looked for the secret, because he said there was a hidden treasure, and the painting showed you where it was. Of course, we never found it, but it kept me quiet on rainy afternoons."
"No, it wasn't great art," said Sir Reynold. "And a man was quite mad, of course. But somehow it spoke to people."
"I wish it had said something to me," said Vimes. "You really don't need to make tea for people, dear. One of the officers—"
"Nonsense! We must be hospitable," said Sybil.
"Of course, people tried to copy it," said the curator, accepting a cup. "Oh, dear, they were terrible. A painting 50 feet long and 10 feet deep is really quite impossible to copy with any kind of accuracy."
"Not if you lay it out on the ballroom floor and get a man to make you a pantograph," said Sybil, pouring tea. "This teapot really is a disgrace, Sam. Worse than the urn. Doesn't anyone ever clean it out?"
She looked up at their faces.
"Did I say something wrong?" she said.
"You made a copy of the rascal," said Sir Reynold.
"Oh, yes. The whole thing, to a scale of 1 in 5, said Sybil. "When I was 14, it was a school project. We were doing dwarf history, you see, and, well, since we owned that painting, it was too good to miss. You know what a pantograph is, don't you? It's a very simple way of making larger or smaller copies of a painting, using geometry, some wooden levers, and a sharp pencil. Actually, I did it as 5 panels, 10 feet square, that's full size, to make sure I got all the detail. And then I did the 1/5 scale version to display it as poor Mr. Rascal wanted it displayed. I got full marks for Miss Turpitude. She was our maths teacher, you know. She wore her hair in a bun with a pair of compasses and a ruler stuck in it. She used to say that a girl who knew how to use a set square and protractor would go a long way in life."
"What a shame you no longer have it," said Sir Reynold.
"Why should you say that, Sir Reynold?" said Sybil. "I'm sure I've still got it somewhere. I had it hanging up from the ceiling of my room for some time. Let me think. Did we take it with us when we moved? I'm sure—" She looked up brightly. "Ah, yes. Have you ever been up into the attics here, Sam?"
"No," said Vimes.
"Now's the time, then."
"I've never been on a girls' night out before," said Cheery, as they walked a little uncertainly through the night-time city. was that last bit supposed to happen?
What bit was that? Said Sally.
The bit where the bar was set on fire.
Not usually, said Angra.
I've never seen men fight over a woman before, Cheery went on.
Yeah, that was something, wasn't it? Said Sally.
They'd dropped Tawny off at her home. She'd been in quite a thoughtful frame of mind.
And all she did was smile at a man, said Cheery.
Yes, said Angra. She was trying to concentrate on walking.
It'd be a bit of a shame for Nobby if she lets that go to her head, though, said Cheery.
Save me from talkative drunks, Angra thought. She said,
Yes, but what about Miss Pushpram? She's thrown some quite expensive fish at Nobby over the years.
We've struck a blow for ugly womanhood, Sally declared loudly. Shoes, men, coffins, and never accept the first one you see.
Oh, shoes, said Cheery. I can talk about shoes. Has anyone seen the new Jan Rockhammer solid copper slingbacks?
Well, we don't go to a metal worker for our footwear, dear, said Sally. I think I'm going to be sick.
Serves you right for drinking wine, said Angua maliciously.
Oh, ha-ha, said the vampire from the shadows. I'm perfectly fine with sarcastic paws vine, thank you. What I shouldn't have drunk was sticky drinks with names made up by people with less sense of humour than... Oh, excuse me. Oh, no.
Are you all right? Said Cheery.
I've just thrown up a small, hilarious paper umbrella.
Oh, dear.
And a sparkler.
Is that you, Sergeant Angua?
Said a voice in the gloom. A lantern was opened and lit the approaching face of Constable Visit. As he drew near, she could just make out the thick wad of pamphlets under his other arm.
"Hello, Washpot," she said. "What's up?"
"Looks like a twist of lemon," said a damp voice from the shadows.
"Mr. Vimes sent me to search the bars of iniquity and low places of sin for you," said Visit.
"And literature?" said Angua.
"By the way, the words nothing personal could so easily have been added to that last sentence."
"Since I was having to tour the temples of vice, Sergeant, I thought I could do alms holy work at the same time," said Visit, whose indefatigable evangelical zeal triumphed over all adversity. "They say there's one in every police station. Constable Visit the Ungodly with explanatory pamphlets was enough for two. Sometimes whole bars full of people would lie down on the floor with the lights out when they heard he was coming down the street. There were sounds of retching from the darkness."
"Woe unto those who abuseth the divine," said Constable Visit.
He caught the expression on Angua's face and added,
"No offence meant."
"We've been through all that," moaned Sally.
"What does he want, Washpot?" said Angua.
"It's about Coombe Valley again. He wants you back at the yard."
"But we were stood down," Sally complained.
"Sorry,"
said Visit cheerfully. "I reckon you've been stood up again."
"The story of my life," said Cheery.
"Oh, well. I suppose we'd better go," said Angua, trying to disguise her relief.
"When I say the story of my life, obviously I don't mean the whole story,"
mumbled Cheery, apparently to herself, as she trailed behind them into a world blessedly without fun. The Ramkins never threw anything away. There was something worrying about their attics, and it wasn't just that they had a faint aroma of long-dead pigeon. The Ramkins labelled things. Vimes had been into the big attics in Schoon Avenue to fetch down the rocking horse and the cot and the whole box of elderly but much-loved soft toys smelling of mothballs. Nothing that might ever be useful again was thrown away. It was carefully labelled and put in the attic. Brushing aside cobwebs with one hand and holding up a lantern with the other, Sybil led the way past boxes of men's boots various, risible puppets, string and glove, model theatre and scenery. Maybe that was the reason for their wealth. They bought things that were built to last, and they seldom, now, had to buy anything at all. Except food, of course, and even then Vimes would not have been surprised to see boxes labelled Apple Cores Various or Leftovers Need Eating Up. That was a phrase of Sybil's that got to him. She'd announce at lunch, "We must have the pork tonight. It needs eating up." Vimes never had an actual problem with this because he'd been raised to eat what was put in front of him, and to do it quickly, too, before someone else snatched it away. He was just puzzled at the suggestion that he was there to do the food a favour.
"Ah, here we are," said Sybil, lifting aside a bundle of fencing foils and lacrosse sticks. She pulled a long, thick tube out into the light. "I didn't colour it in, of course," she said as it was manhandled back to the stairs. "That would have taken forever." Getting the heavy bundle down to the canteen took some effort and a certain amount of shoving, but eventually it was lifted onto the table and the crackling scroll removed. While Sir Reynold unrolled the big 10-foot squares and enthused, Vimes pulled out the small-scale copy that Sybil had created. It was just small enough to fit on the table. He weighed down one end with a crusted mug and put a salt cellar on the other. Rascal's notes made sad reading. Difficult reading, too, because a lot of them were half-burned, and in any case his handwriting was what might have been achieved by a spider on a trampoline during an earthquake. The man was clearly as mad as a spoon, writing notes that he wanted to keep secret from the chicken. Sometimes he'd stop writing in mid-note if he thought the chicken was watching. Apparently, he was a very sad sight to see until he picked up a brush, whereupon he would work quite quietly and with a strange glow to his features. And that was his life. One huge oblong of canvas. Methodia Rascal. Born, painted famous picture, thought he was a chicken, died. Given that the man couldn't touch the bottom with a long stick, how could you make sense out of anything he wrote? The only note that seemed concise, if horrible, was the one generally accepted as his last, since it was found under his slumped body. It read, "Ork, ork, it comes." He'd choked, with a throat full of feathers. And on the canvas, the last of the paint was still drying. Vimes's eye was caught by the message numbered arbitrarily number 39. "I thought it was a guiding omen, but it screams in the night." An omen of what? And what about number 143? "The dark, in the dark, like a star in chains." Vimes had made a note of that one. He'd made a note of many others, too, but the worst thing about them, or the best, if you were keen on mysteries, was that they could mean anything. You could pick your own theory. The man was half-starved and in mortal dread of a chicken that lived in his head. You might as well try to make sense of raindrops. Vimes pushed them aside and stared at the careful pencil drawing. Even at this size it was confusing. Up front, faces were so large that you could see the pores on a dwarf's nose. In the distance, Sybil had meticulously copied figures that were a quarter of an inch high. Axes and clubs were being waved. Spears were being pointed. There were charges and countercharges and single combats. Across the whole length of the picture, dwarfs and trolls were locked in a ferocious battle, hacking and smashing. He thought, who's missing? "Sir Reynold, could you help me?" he said quietly, lest the nascent thought turn tail and run. "Yes, Commander," said the curator, hurrying over. "Doesn't Lady Sybil do the most exquisite?" "She's very good, yes," said Vimes. "Tell me, how did Rascal know all this stuff?" "There were many dwarf songs about it, and some troll stories. Oh, and some humans witnessed it." "So Rascal could have read about it?" "Oh, yes. Apart from the fact that he put it in the wrong part of the valley, he got it down quite accurately." Vimes didn't take his gaze off the paper battle. "Does anyone know why he put it in the wrong place, then?" he said. "There are several theories. One is that he was deceived by the stories that the dead dwarfs were cremated at that end of the valley. But after the storm, that is where many of the bodies ended up. There was also a great deal of dead wood for bonfires, but I believe he chose that end because the view is so much better. The mountains are so dramatic." Vimes sat down, staring at the sketch, willing it to yield its secret. "Everyone will know the secret in a few weeks," Mr. Shine had said. "Why?" "Sir Reynold, was anything going to happen to the painting in the next couple of weeks?" he said. "Oh, yes," said the curator. "We would have installed it in its new room." "Anything special about that?" "I did tell your sergeant, Commander," said the curator a little reproachfully. "It is circular. Rascal always intended it to be seen in a round, as it were, so that the viewer could be there." "And I'm nearly there too," Vimes thought. "I think the cube told the dwarfs something about Coombe Valley," he said in a faraway voice, because he felt as though he was already in the valley. "It told them
that the place where it was found was important. Even Rascal thought it was important. They needed a map, and Rascal painted one, even if he didn't know it. Fred?
Yes, sir.
The dwarfs weren't bothered about damaging the bottom of the painting because it doesn't contain anything important. It's just people. People move around.
But with respect, Commander, so do all those boulders, said Sir Reynold.
They don't matter. No matter how much the valley has changed, this picture will work, said Vimes. The glow of understanding lit his brain.
But even the rivers move over the years, and any amount of boulders have rolled down from the mountains, said Sir Reynold. I'm told the area looks nothing like that now.
Even so, said Vimes in the same dreamy voice, this map will work for thousands of years. It doesn't mark a rock or a hollow or a cave. It just marks a spot. I can pinpoint it. That is, if I had a pin.
I have one, said Sir Reynold triumphantly, reaching to his lapel. I spotted one in the street yesterday, and of course we all know the old saying, see a pin and pick it up, and all day long...
Yes, thank you, said Vimes, taking it. He walked to the end of the table, picked up one end of the painting, and dragged it back down the length of the table, the heavy paper flapping after him. He pinned the two ends together, held up the circle he had made, and lowered it over his head.
"The truth is in the mountains," he said. "For years you've been looking at a line of mountains. It's really a circle of mountains."
"But I knew that," said Sir Reynold.
"In a way, sir, but you probably didn't understand it until now, yes?"
"Well, yes, but it was a cave, Commander. He specifically mentions a cave. That's why people have searched along the valley walls. The painting's set right in the middle near the river."
"Then there's something we still don't know," said Vimes. "I'll find out what it is when I get there."
"There," he'd said it. But he'd known that he was going to go. Known for how long? It seemed like forever. But had it seemed like forever yesterday? This afternoon? He could see the place in his mind's eye. Vimes at Coombe Valley. He could practically taste the air. He could hear the roaring of the river, which ran as cold as ice.
"Sam!"
Sybil began. "No! This has got to be sorted out," Vimes said quickly. "I don't care about the stupid secret. Those deep-downers murdered our dwarfs, remember? They think the painting is a map they can use, and that's why they're going there. I've got to go after them."
"Look, Sam, if—"
Sybil tried. "We can't afford a war between the trolls and the dwarfs, dear. That business the other night was just a dumb gang fight. A real war in Ankh-Morpork would wreck the place, and somehow it's all tied up with this."
"I agree. I want to come, too,"
Sybil screamed.
"Besides, I'll be perfectly safe if—"
"What?"
Vimes gaped at his wife while his mental gears ripped into reverse.
"No, it's too dangerous."
"Sam Vimes, I've dreamed of visiting Coombe Valley all my life, so don't dare think for one moment you're gallivanting off to see it and leaving me at home."
"I don't gallivant. I've never gallivanted. I don't know how to vant. I don't even have a galley. But there's going to be a war there soon."
"Then I shall tell them we're not involved," said Sybil calmly.
"That won't work."
"Then it won't work in Ankh-Morpork either," said Sybil, with the air of a player cunningly knocking out four dwarfs in one go. "Sam, you know you're going to lose this. There's no point in arguing. Besides, I speak dwarfish. We'll take young Sam too."
"No."
"So that's all sorted then," said Sybil, apparently struck by sudden deafness. "If you want to catch up with the dwarfs, I suggest we leave as soon as possible."
Sir Reynold turned to her with his mouth open.
"But, Lady Sybil, armies are already massing there. That's no place for a lady."
Vimes winced. Sybil had made up her mind. This was going to be like watching that dwarf being flamed by dragons all over again. Lady Sybil's bosom, which she was allowed to have, grew as she took a deep breath. It seemed to lift her slightly off the ground.
"Sir Reynold," she said, with a side order of ice. "In the year of the lice, my great-grandmother once cooked, personally, a full dinner for 18 in a military redoubt that was entirely surrounded by bloodthirsty Clachians, and she felt able to include sorbet and nuts. My grandmother, in the year of the Quiet Monkey, defended our embassy in Pseudopolis against a mob with no assistance but that offered by a gardener, a trained parrot, and a pan of hot chip-fat. My late aunt, when our coach was once held up at bow point by two desperate highwaymen, gave them such a talking to that they actually ran away crying for their mothers, Sir Reynold, their mothers. We are no strangers to danger, Sir Reynold. May I also remind you that quite probably half the dwarfs who fought at Coombe Valley were ladies? No one told them to stay at home.
So that's settled, then, thought Vimes. We... damn.
Captain, he said, send someone to find that dwarf Greg Bashfulson, will you? Tell him Commander Vimes presents his compliments and will be leaving first thing in the morning.
Right, sir, will do, said Carrot.
How did he know I'd be going, Vimes wondered.
I suppose it was inevitable. But he could have hung us out to dry if he'd said we'd mistreated that dwarf. And he's one of Mr. Shine's pupils, I'll bet on it. Good idea to keep an eye on him, perhaps.
When did Lord Vetinari sleep? Presumably the man must get his head down at some point, Vimes reasoned. Everyone slept. Catnaps could get you by for a while, but sooner or later you needed a solid 8 hours, right? It was almost midnight, and there was Vetinari at his desk, fresh as a daisy and chilly as morning dew.
I really do need you here, Vimes. Carrot can look after things. They've quietened down anyway. I think most of the serious troublemakers have headed for Coombe Valley.
A good reason, one might say, for you not to go, Vimes. I have agents for this sort of thing.
More murder in the dark, you mean? Said Vimes. No, sir. This is a straightforward police matter.
Not murder, Vimes. Not murder, said Vetinari.
One could call it an acceptable level of nemesis.
Call it what you like, sir. I don't like it. I intend to bring the suspects back alive. It's a thing we try to do in the watch.
No, Vimes. This is a matter for the Low King. I shall send him a clax directly.
He has agents too, does he? Said Vimes sourly.
Indeed. Even in this city, just as I have in his.
That is called politics, Vimes. It is a thing we try to do in the government.
Agents here, spying on us. I thought we were chums with the Low King.
Of course we are. And the more we know about each other, the friendlier we shall remain. We'd hardly bother to spy on our enemies. What would be the point?
If you don't let me take a squad to Coombe Valley, Vimes growled.
Yes.
What will you do? Said Vetinari.
Sybil will come and ask you.
Vetinari gazed at Vimes in silent wonder.
Lady Sybil is letting you go, he said.
She's coming with me. So are Fred and Nobby. And I want to take Angua, Sully, Detritus and Cheery. Multi-species, sir. That always helps.
And the summoning dark? What about that, Vimes?
Oh, don't look at me like that. It's common talk among the dwarfs. One of the dying dwarfs put a curse on everyone who was in the mine, I'm told.
I wouldn't know about that, sir, said Vimes, resorting to the wooden expression that so often saw him through.
It's mystic. We don't do mystic in the watch.
It's not a joke, Vimes. It's very old magic, I understand. So old, indeed, that most dwarfs have forgotten that it is magic. And it's powerful. It will be tracking them.
I'll just look out for a big floaty eye with a tail, then, shall I? Said Vimes. That should make it easy.
Vimes, I know you must be aware that the symbol is not the thing itself, said the patrician.
Yes, sir, I know.
But magic has no place in coppering. We don't use it to find culprits, we don't use it to get confessions. Because you can't trust the bloody stuff, sir. It's got a mind of its own. If there's a curse chasing these bastards, well, that's its business. But if I reach them first, sir, then they'll be my prisoners, and it'll have to get past me.
Vimes, Arch-Chancellor Ridcully tells me he believes it may be a quasi-demonic entity that is untold millions of years old.
I've said my piece, sir, said Vimes, staring at a point just above Lord Vetinari's head. "'And it is my duty to catch up with these people. "'I believe they may be able to help me with my inquiries.
"'But you have no evidence, Vimes, "'and you are going to need very solid evidence.
"'Right. "'So I want to bring them back here, eyeballs on a string or not, "'them and their damn guards, so's I can inquire. "'Someone will tell me something.'
"'And it'll also be to your personal satisfaction,' said Vetinari sharply.
"'Is this a trick question, sir?'
"'Well done. Well done,' said Vetinari softly. "'Lady Sybil is a remarkable woman, Vimes.'
"'Yes, sir, she is.'
Vimes left.
After a while, Veterinari's chief clerk, Drumknot, entered the room on velvet feet and placed a cup of tea in front of Veterinari.
"Thank you, Drumknot. You were listening?"
"Yes, the commander seemed very forthright."
"They invaded his home, Drumknot."
"Quite, sir."
Veterinari leaned back and stared at the ceiling.
"Tell me, Drumknot, are you a betting man?"
"I have been known to have the occasional little flutter, sir."
"Given, then, a contest between an invisible and very powerful quasi-demonic thing of pure vengeance on the one hand, and the commander on the other, where would you wager, say, $1?
"I wouldn't, sir. That looks like one that would go to the judges."
"Yes," said Veterinari, staring thoughtfully at the closed door. "Yes, indeed."
"I don't use magic," thought Vimes, walking through the rain towards Unseen University, "but sometimes I tell lies." He avoided the main entrance and headed as circumspectly as possible for Wizard's Passage, where, halfway down, university access for all was available via several loose bricks. Generations of rascally drunk student wizards had used them to get back in late at night. Later on, they'd become very important and powerful wizards with full beards and fuller stomachs, but had never lifted a finger to have the wall repaired. It was, after all, traditional. Nor was it usually patrolled by the lobsters, the university porters, or bledlows, who doubled with rather more enthusiasm as its proctors. They commanded their nickname for being thick-shelled, liable to turn red when hot, and having the smallest brain for their size of any known creature. The lobsters, who believed in tradition even more than the wizards. On this occasion, though, one was lurking in the shadows, and he jumped when Vimes tapped him on the shoulder.
"Oh, it's you, Commander Vimes, sir. It's me, Wiggly, sir. The Arch-Chancellor is waiting for you in the gardener's hut, sir. Follow me, sir. Mum's the word, eh, sir?"
Vimes trailed after Wiggly across the dark, squelchy lawns. Oddly, though, he didn't feel so tired now. Days and days of bad sleep, and he felt quite fresh, in a fuzzy sort of way. It was the smell of the chase, that's what it was. He'd pay for it later. Wiggly, first looking both ways with a conspiratorial air that would have attracted instant attention had anyone been watching, opened the door of the garden shed. There was a large figure waiting inside.
"Commander!" it bellowed happily. "What larks, eh? Very cloak and dagger!"
Only heavy rain could possibly muffle the voice of Arch-Chancellor Ridcully when he was feeling cheerful.
"Could you keep it down a bit, Arch-Chancellor?" said Vimes, shutting the door quickly.
"Sorry! I mean, sorry!" said the wizard. "Do take a seat. The compost sacks are quite acceptable. Well, how may I help you, Sam?"
"Can we agree for now that you can't?" said Vimes.
"Intriguing. Do continue," said Ridcully, leaning closer.
"You know I won't have magic used in the watch," Vimes went on.
As he sat down in the semi-darkness, a coiled-up hosepipe ambushed him from above, as they do, and he had to wrestle it to the shed floor.
"I do, sir, and I respect you for it, although there are those that think you're a damn silly fool."
"Well," Vimes said, trying to put damn silly fool behind them, "the fact is I must get to Coombe Valley very fast. Very fast indeed."
"Well, I might say magically fast," said Ridcully.
"As it were," said Vimes, fidgeting. He really hated having to do this. And what had he sat on?
"Hmm," said Ridcully. "But without, I imagine, any significant hocus-pocus. You appear uncomfortable, sir."
Vimes triumphantly held up a large onion.
"Sorry,"
he said, tossing it aside. "No, definitely no pocus. Possibly a little hocus. I just need an edge. They got a day's start on me."
"I see. You'll be travelling alone?"
"No, there will have to be 11 of us, 2 coaches."
"My word! And disappearing in a puff of smoke to reappear elsewhere is,
"Out of the question. I just need
an edge," said the wizard.
"Yes.
Something magical in its cause, but not in its effect. Nothing too obvious."
"And no chance of anyone being turned into a frog or anything like that," said Vimes quickly.
"Of course," said Ridcully.
He clapped his hands together.
"Well, Commander, I'm afraid we can't help you. Meddling in things like this is not what wizarding is all about."
He lowered his voice and went on.
"We will particularly not be able to help you if you have the coaches empty around the back in, call it about an hour."
"Oh? Ah, right," said Vimes, trying to catch up. "You're not going to make them fly or anything, are you?"
"We're not going to do anything, Commander,"
said Ridcully jovially, slapping him on the back. "I thought that was agreed. And I think also you should leave now, although, of course, you have in fact not been here. And neither have I. I say, this spying business is pretty clever, eh?"
When Vimes had gone, Mushroom Ridcully sat back, lit his pipe, and, as an afterthought, used the last of the match to light the candle lantern on the potting table. The gardener could get pretty acerbic if people messed about with his shed, so perhaps he ought to tidy up a bit. He stared at the floor, where a tumbled hosepipe and a fallen onion made what looked, at a casual glance, like a large eyeball with a tail. The rain cooled Vimes down. It had cooled down the streets, too. You have to be really keen to riot in the rain. Besides, news of last night had got around. No one was sure, of course, and such were the effects of Fluff and Big Hammer that a large, if elementary, school of thought had been left uncertain about what really had happened. They'd woken up feeling bad, right? Something must have happened, and tonight the rain was setting in, so maybe it was better to stay in the pub. He walked through the wet, whispering darkness, mind ablaze. How fast could those dwarfs travel? Some of them sounded pretty old, but they'd be tough and old. Even so, the roads in that direction were none too good, and a body could only stand so much shaking. And Sybil was taking young Sam. That was stupid. Except that it wasn't stupid, not after dwarfs had broken into your home. Home was where you had to feel safe. If you didn't feel safe, it wasn't home. Against all common sense, he agreed with Sybil. Home was where they were together. She'd already sent off an urgent clax to some old chum of hers who lived near the valley. She seemed to think that it was going to be some kind of family outing. There was a group of dwarfs hanging around on a corner, heavily armed. Maybe the bars were all full, or maybe they needed cooling down too. No law against hanging around, right? Wrong, growled Vimes as he drew nearer. Come along, boys, say something wrong. Lay hold of a weapon, move slightly, breathe loudly. Give me something that could be stretched to in self-defence. It'd be my word against yours, and believe me, lads, I'm unlikely to leave you capable of saying a single damn thing. The dwarfs took one clear look at the approaching vision, haloed in torchlight and mist, and took to their heels. Right. The entity known as the Summoning Dark sped through streets of eternal night, past misty buildings of memory that wavered at its passage. It was getting there. It was getting there. It was having to change the habits of millennia, but it was finding ways in, even if they were no bigger than keyholes. It had never had to work this hard before, never had to move this fast. It was exhilarating. But always, when it paused by some grating or unguarded chimney, it heard the pursuit. It was slow, but it never stopped following. Sooner or later, it would catch up.